quite a comfortable chair for
I'm
you.
I'm going to get comfortable, yes. Taking my pants
if
off.
If you nod off any time. Yeah, take your shoes off, take your pants off. I always do these nude too.
Oh, well, that's nice. Just bottom down though, right?
Yeah, just to give you something to look at.
This is very comfortable chair. When we do these in the UK, we don't have comfortable chairs.
Nothing in the UK is comfortable. You've been around so long and you can't like put a little R&D into comfy.
Yeah.
It's very strange. Everything's too small. I think it's because everything's just so old. Like, it's worked. It worked for centuries. Why change it?
Why change it? Why learn from decades of history?
A little plant in the corner.
Yeah. That's my tribute to Zach Galifianakis.
Between one palm.
Yeah. Well, we'll probably just start. Yeah?
I don't see why not.
I've got all sorts of things.
I've got a haircut to get to.
Have you? When do you need to be out of here?
No, I have plenty of time. I'm kidding. But seriously, I have to get a haircut.
David Tennant does a podcast with...
John Hamm.
So, John Hamm, thank you for being here.
That's me. My name sounds so cool in Scottish. I think everything sounds cooler in the Scottish accent, though.
Do you do a good Scottish accent?
I used to think I did. I'll warm up to it. We'll get to it later.
Okay. I'll lure you in. Mm-hmm. Wear you down, and then you can try it.
Yeah, well, I did when I would do Craig Ferguson.
Oh, yeah.
I would inevitably start talking like him. He's a nice guy.
Yeah. Do you do a lot of accents? Have you worked in accents?
I have before. I did a series for Sky Arts called The Young Doctor's Notebook I had to do some version of a British accent, which I was not excoriated for in the British press, so I felt slightly vindicated on that end. But I don't know. I was such a Monty Python freak when I was growing up that I just learned all of these. I had no context for them.
Yeah.
I just thought, oh, this is what that person sounds like. I didn't know he was a northerner or a southerner
right.
or a Welshman or what have you. I just thought, oh, that's an interesting way of talking, and I think I'm going to try to do that. So I never really studied them in earnest other than just sort of mimicking.
Your first ever acting role, I believe, was a classical English character.
It sure was.
Did you do that in the traditional English accent that Winnie the
Pooh
was known for?
Do you think Winnie had a was Winnie posh? I can't imagine. He must be. I guess he was.
Well, I guess in the original books he was envisioned that way, but Disney made him American, I guess.
Sure.
Didn't he?
Yeah, he was quite American, and he was sort of like an old man. He was sort of a befuddled old man. I did him in the voice of as loud as I could, 5-year-old.
So first grade is five.
First grade is 5 years old. Yeah. Kindergarten, first grade. It depends upon when your birthday is. There's a whole like rigmarole they have to go through.
Right, we have that too, yeah.
That was my first acting job. We did a play. Our whole first grade did it.
But you were the Pooh.
Only one Winnie.
Yeah. Was it an extensive audition process?
No. In fact, I was told by my teacher that I was to play Winnie the Pooh because I was the only person who would stand up in front of people and be loud.
So you
and to this day, that is pretty much the definition of my acting.
So what was life like as a child in St. Louis, Missouri? Was it rural? Was it industrial?
It's not industrial. Where did you grow up? Glasgow?
Yeah, no, just outside Glasgow. Paisley. Just outside
so you
Glasgow.
Grew up in a suburb?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a suburb, basically. Right. That's where I grew up. The city of St. Louis in the 70s was very much a big business town. It's located right in the middle of the country. And it was a great place to grow up as a kid. I went to public school and had a bunch of friends and we all ran around, you know, we'd get out of school and sort of meet up by the, you know, by the road sign. And then we would disperse to various activities, you know, depending upon what season it was. Oh, it's football season. Oh, it's, you know, Frisbee season or, you know, basketball season, swimming, whatever it was. And that was basically what growing up was just running around, being outside all day. It was a pre-video game, pre-everything, really. You know, three channels of television. And I was raised by a single mom. So I kind of had free rein until my mom got home at 5:30 or whatever. And, you know, I was allowed to stay out till the streetlights came on and the sun went down and, you know, my mom would have that time to kind of decompress after work and eventually cook dinner and do homework and go to sleep and get up and do it all over again. My mom and dad got divorced when I was 2 years old.
Wow.
So we were pretty, you know, we didn't really want for anything, but I didn't really want anything.
Mm.
I had everything I wanted. I had a baseball glove and I had tennis shoes and whatever I didn't have, somebody else in the neighborhood did, then we could share it. I had a bicycle, you know, like your basics as a kid. I didn't really want for anything.
And you would all, as kids, you would just roam around. You'd be out all the time.
It was a pack, like a crazy pack.
That feels like that's changed within our lifetime.
Well, I think people are so terrified. I think, you know, there have always been bad guys, right? There's always been the creepy people on the fringe. But what the internet has done is made those boogeymen, move them from the fringe into the front and center, and has suggested that everybody's like that, or more people than you think, or, oh, don't trust anybody. You can only trust yourself or your people or whatever. And it's kind of like, well, that's not true at all. You know, you don't need to be a total gullible fool, but mostly people are good. I fully believe that. I think that most people are kind. Most people don't have, you know, horrible prejudice and whatever. Or if they do, when presented with it face to face, it kind of melts away because it's so much easier to do that in a anonymous online kind of space and spew vitriol and hatred and all this nonsense when you don't have to own up to it and you don't have to be, you know, look at it in the face or have somebody look you in the face while you do it. It's much more difficult.
Do you think kids in St. Louis now could still be having that lifestyle but probably don't?
Well, I think also there's so many more things to do that are entertaining. You know, I think probably kids get together now and go play Fortnite for 5 hours instead of going and running around and playing kickball. I mean, I probably would too, honestly. Like, I hear it's a pretty fun game. I've never played it, but, at least it's communal, kind of.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, I think that that's just the culture has shifted into more indoor games than outdoor games. You know, I'm not going to sit here and say it's better or worse or anything. I loved the way I grew up. I still love being outside. That's why I live in LA. You know, you can be outside for 10 months out of the year. It never rains. I can walk outside my house and in five steps I'm in Griffith Park and I can walk for 75 minutes and, you know, do a whole loop and come back to my house and I feel great.
So you look back on that childhood as a very happy time,
for the most part, like any child, you know, it wasn't without its difficulties, but for the most part, I mean.
But your mom got sick when you were very young.
She did. She was diagnosed with colon cancer at the age of 35 when I was 9 years old.
Yikes.
And, you know, again, in the 70s, there was not a lot of screening and the things that we have now. So had she gone through that experience in the 2000s, she most likely would have lived because it probably would have been caught much earlier. Right. But by the time they got to it, it had spread throughout her, you know, her major organs in her abdomen. So the liver and the stomach and the gallbladder and, you know, everything in there was riddled with cancer. And so she passed away fairly quickly over the course of about 3 weeks. She went from diagnosis to death, and that was pretty rough to watch.
And at nine, how aware are you of what's going on?
Not very. And again, it's...
Are you being told or is it being kept from
you? You're being kind of told in a very indirect way. And so, at nine, you're kind of like, why is everybody around me losing their shit and crying? Mm. And why are all the adults who are supposed to be very put together and running the show, why are they losing it? And so you have no kind of concept of it. You think, oh, something bad must be happening. But it's certainly not the go-to thing you think of. Then it happens, and it's devastating, and it's permanent. And it's it was my first experience with anything permanent at nine. You don't think anything's permanent. I was given a book. The title was What to Do When a Parent Dies.
Yikes.
Which I read, and I was like, okay, I read it. That process ended up taking probably the next 20 years of my life.
Of course.
Whether I knew it or not.
Yeah.
That's why I went into therapy at a certain point and I'm still in it. It's like helpful.
Yeah.
You know, we don't directly talk about my mom very much anymore, but I still can recognize that, you know, the fear of abandonment and the fear of certain things are tied into that. And you kind of just clock it and try to be aware of it and try to understand that, okay, that's coming from. So that's either irrational or something that it's emotional. So I should probably just put a pin in it and realize that that's not necessarily a thing that I need to deal with right now. I can worry about that later.
Were you aware enough of what was going on to be scared?
The only thing I found scary was the adults' reaction to it.
Right.
Because it was so out of I'd never seen all the adults in my life kind of not in charge of their own, you know, emotions right. and selves. I just remember looking around the waiting room and my grandfather, who was a Navy man, like World War II veteran, like was by himself, like looking out the window, like sobbing. I could tell from the back, you know, because his shoulders were kind of doing this. And I was like, well, I've never seen that happen. And I never saw it again in my life. And my grandmother had a tissue to her nose or her eyes or something. And my aunts were all in the corner kind of huddled and talking about something. I was like, what is happening here? So it was just kind of discomforting, but it wasn't really scary. It was just kind of like, what's happening? What's going on here? And of course, then no one was really honest or felt like they could be honest because he's just a little kid. He doesn't know what's going on.
Hmm.
Kids know more than you think.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
You realize that.
So you then went and lived with your dad?
I lived with my dad until I went off to college. Yeah.
So he got the difficult teenage years, did he? Were they difficult
yes
teenage
and
years?
Yes no. You know, I was... I was kind of an outlier as a teenager, I think, because I lived with my dad, but my dad lived in his childhood home. So he basically had moved back in with his mom. So I lived with my father and my grandmother in my grandmother's old house, which was this massive kind of old place in North County, St. Louis. And we had 2.5 acres of land in the back, which was great for me. But I ended up going to a school that was very far away. This is when I transferred into a private school in seventh grade. And so none of my friends live nearby. So that whole kind of communal friend thing kind of went away. And I had to but I was also like 13, 14, getting old enough to be like, oh, I want to hang out with my friends at different venues. I was an athlete in school. I had a lot of after school stuff, whether it was theater or what have you. So I was just basically at work the whole time. Right. I mean, I was working the whole time. I found my way to get into trouble as much as I could. But, you know, I was a very, very diligent student and a very, very diligent athlete as well. And I also knew that this particular school was the place that my mom wanted me, where she wanted me to go.
Right.
So I felt very much beholden to that kind of promise.
Right.
Of not wasting the opportunity.
So you're doing a lot of sport, you're doing a bit of theater, but you're still not thinking, I'm going to be an actor.
No, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I knew I did not want to worry about money because, you know, as comfortable as we were, money was always a looming something somewhere. And I knew enough people in my life who seemingly didn't have that problem. And I thought, well, I'd rather not have that problem than have that problem.
Yeah.
And it took me a long time to get to the place where I didn't have to worry about that.
But, electing to become an actor is not a surefire way of not having to worry about money.
Yeah, there's way better ways to make a living.
Yeah.
And eventually I had gone to the University of Texas and on a scholarship because I had really crazy grades in high school and crazy test scores. I was
very, very
high end of that whole spectrum. And then just proceeded to party my way out of that nonsense. Freshman year in college was like, I was off the leash, basically.
Really? So you'd been quite a good boy at high school.
Absolutely.
And then you went crazy.
Yeah, because I didn't need to do all the classes I was taking, I basically had already taken in high school.
Right.
So I was just like, this is ridiculous.
From what you're saying, it was all quite easy for you, mm-hmm. I guess.
So then, yeah, I was able to get into a local college. I wanted to continue my education. I wanted to stay in with some kind of sense of stability and organization in my life and a schedule.
Mm-hmm.
So I got back up to speed from an educational standpoint and then transferred to the big university in Columbia, Missouri. And that's when I literally opened the student newspaper one day and there was a thing in the newspaper. It said, Midsummer Night's Dream, come audition. It's a professional outfit out of Chicago. They're casting the four young lovers as students. And I looked at my roommate, who was a friend of mine from St. Louis. And I was like, I'm going to do this. He's like, yeah, you should. You're good. And I took the little paper and I figured out where it was and I signed in and I got the part.
Which one?
Lysander.
Excellent. And it was a fully professional production.
I mean, we didn't get paid, but they were pros, the standard apparently.
Ones. Right.
But it was beautiful. It was a beautiful production, and it was, you know, for you know, a mid-Missouri regional theater production of Shakespeare, it was pretty great.
Yeah.
And it was that, I think, was when I was like, oh, okay, I could probably do this. I did about 15 plays in 2 years, 2.5 years. I learned a lot. I met a lot of great people. Very talented people. I got to learn so much, and that was kind of my
That was your drama
conservatory, you know, education. But it was fun. It was also really fun. And I think for the first time in my life, I started having not in my life, but the first time in a long time, coming out of kind of a depressive fog and being like, oh, joy and life and love and fun and creativity and feedback, positive feedback. I was like, oh, this is something. This is something. And then, you know, I graduated, and it was kind of like, now what? In the States, you have two places to go, really, New York and L.A., if you want to be an actor. Chicago's kind of a distant third.
But you don't. You go home first.
Well, that's what I did. I went home first.
We're always thinking, I'll get around to it? Or
well, thinking I didn't have any money.
Right.
So I was like, okay, I have to go. I have to go home and get a job. I have to make some money.
But you work as a teacher in your old high school.
I was a waiter for about a year, and I made great money, and I was able to get my own place. And then I had petitioned my old school, and the acting teacher at my old school, who was my acting teacher my senior year. I said, you know, since you've come to the school over the last 4 years or so, the program has been wildly popular. Everybody wants to take your class. You're overworked. Why don't you hire essentially like a junior professor, and I can teach the class? I just got out of college. I did all this stuff, you know, improv and whatnot. And whatever I don't know, you can hand me the lesson plan, and I can go through it, and teach these kids. And I was 24 years old. I was like, I can do anything.
Yeah.
And so the headmaster's like, great, you know, you're cheap, at the very least, like we can afford you. And I was like, cool, this will be great. And then I had a 9th through 11th grade scene study class, and that was the class that Ellie Kemper was in.
She was you everything.
She was fantastic, even as a 15-year-old 9th grader in a class where she was on the younger end of.
Right.
So she was probably very daunted by the older girls who were very good, and boys.
Were you a good teacher?
I thought so. I mean, I think the feedback was all pretty strong, and in fact, they wanted to bring me back for a second year, so I guess I was okay. And I know I liked it, but I remember turning 25, I guess, and thinking like, okay, quarter century, it's time to go. Like, I need to try this if I'm going to try it.
Yeah.
And not that I felt old, but I just felt like, I know if I stay here and do this another year, I'll be here for 20 years.
Yeah.
At least. And I don't want to be here for 20 years.
Yeah.
And think, whoa, what might have been?
Were there any precedents? I mean, did you know any actors? Did you?
I didn't know really anybody. I knew one person that I knew was in L.A., Paul Rudd.
And
Paul was the college roommate of a family friend of mine, and I had met him. I was 17. He was 18 or 19, or I was 18. He was 19. So he's a year older than me or 2 years older than me. And I knew he had gone out there because we'd become friends through this mutual friend. And so I knew one person. And I had an aunt and uncle that lived out here, too. So I had a place to stay, and I had a one person to call.
Right.
So that's all I really thought I needed. I was like, okay, I'll do that. And then I pointed my car west, and I had literally $150 in cash, a couple of credit cards that I wasn't sure would go through or not. And it was like, okay, this is it. So I went on a million auditions, and I got a million no's.
Literally nothing.
Well, I would get to a certain point, and then they wouldn't
cast
me. And it was, again, it was in the 90s, like 95, 96. I remember being in rooms with Bradley Cooper, with Heath Ledger. There was a show on Fox that came down to me and Heath Ledger.
Right.
Heath Ledger got it. And I remember thinking, like, who's going to hire an Australian? This is crazy. Turns out...
Yeah.
A lot of people want to hire.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I just, those couple years were me learning what I didn't know about this business, which was a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone's got to go through it. If you don't, you're lucky. Sure. You know, if you catch lightning in a bottle and you get a gig and you happen to be good in it and it all works out, that's luck. Mm. And you need some of that, obviously.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere. And no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
It took me 3 years of almost. I mean, I lost jobs to Jon Favreau.
Right.
Jon's a friend of mine now. I see him all the time. I'm like, you know, you beat me out for a part, right? And he's like, what? He didn't even remember it. I'm like, yeah, buddy.
You keep going. You don't get. I mean, you must have got discouraged.
You get discouraged, but you know, I think at a certain point, because you know enough people and you've been around long enough, you're like, oh, everybody, this is everybody's experience. You hear no way more than you hear yes.
How bleak do you get, though?
The bleakest I probably got was right before I got Mad Men. And I'd been working a lot before that, but I had tested for 7 pilots. And by tested, I mean gotten to the very, very, very end.
Yeah, signed the contract.
Signed the contract, went to the network, blah, blah, blah. I had tested for 7 pilots. One, let's say, infamous television studio had, at a certain point, told my manager to stop sending me in because I'll never be a television star.
Wow.
And I was like, how bad could I have been? Like, I was clearly not terrible. I got this far. But that's where I was when Mad Men came around. Mad Men came around very, very, very late in the pilot season.
Uh-huh.
Everyone that wanted jobs had jobs already. And this was like kind of the last one circling the drain. And I thought it was the best pilot I'd ever read.
So but you start working and it's all beginning to cloak along. And then you're in your mid-30s, you read the script for Mad Men.
Yeah. For somebody that had the credits that I had, I started at the very, very, very bottom of the list. In fact, I had to pre-read, and I don't know if you even remember what that is, but that's like reading for the casting director before you even meet anybody.
Before you even meet any of the grown-ups. Right.
And because the casting directors were out of New York and they didn't know who I was. And so I climbed that ladder fairly quickly, but I had 8 auditions at least, 7-8 auditions for Mad Men.
8?
Yeah.
And every time it's like a...
Do or die. And I'm like, I know what this is. This is me being great until they find the movie star that they're going to put in this part.
Yeah, yeah.
But fortunately for me, Matt Weiner fell in love with me, basically. He really liked me. And B, it was so late in the pilot season that all the movie stars were gone.
Right.
Or all the TV stars were gone. This has been an era when movie stars didn't do TV.
Uh-huh.
Now it would have been a totally, you know, it probably could have got George Clooney to play. You know, it's like.
Through all these hoops, are you managing to remain focused? Are you managing to remain calm? Or are the stakes,
I think I was. I remember sitting at a bar with my friend and saying, like, I never say this, but I really, really want this job. And he goes, there's nothing wrong with saying that. I go, yeah, but I'm jinxing it. Well, he goes, no. He goes, so go get it. And I was like, you're right. Why not me? And that was when I first started thinking, like, why not me?
Yeah.
I'm as good as anybody. I'm like, why not me? I'm good for this role.
And was the quality of the script such that you were thinking, this is a life changer if I get this one?
No, it was a great script, but it was on a network that no one had heard of.
Yeah, of course.
So you think, like, oh, this could be the greatest pilot that no one sees. There's a million of those.
Mm. So it was made as a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
You made one, and then did you have a long wait?
A year.
A year? Mm-hmm. Waiting to see if it was going to get picked up.
Yeah.
When you were not allowed to do anything else, or you're...
No, I was able to do, like, a thing here and there, and I always stay busy. Like, it's...
Why did they take so long to...
Because it was expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And the partner that they had that made the pilot did not have the funds to stick around as an equity partner in the run of the series, so they had to go find somebody else. Nobody wanted it. They eventually found Lionsgate, who picked it up for a song, and it was one of the better investments Lionsgate's ever made.
Yeah.
So it was.
So after a year, did they remake the pilot, or does the pilot?
No, we had the pilot.
That's still episode one.
That was there, and then episode 2 started about a year later.
Oh, right.
So we just picked up where we left off on episode one and started episode two just a year later. And everyone was kind of like, oh, we're doing this now? Like, what was I doing? I don't remember. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
It took a minute to kind of get back into that world and into that mode.
And this is the first time you've been number one on the call sheet. This is the first time you're...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you consciously plan how to be?
No. I remember day one on the pilot, 5 o'clock in the morning, something like that. You know, first day, no one knows anybody. We're all meeting each other for the first time. It was about a 3-page scene with me and John Slattery. It's in the pilot. I come in after a hard night. He's chirping in my ear about you're late and this and that. And we have this meeting and this meeting and that meeting. And I don't have very many lines, but I've got to take my shirt off, take my tie off, put 2 Alka-Seltzer in a thing, make sure that's going, take another shirt out of the deal, take it out, put it on, retie my tie. While he's telling me all these things we have to do, miss a button on purpose because the last line is you missed a button, drink the Alka-Seltzer and be like, I'm ready to go. He goes, you missed a button, and then we're out. So there's just, it's all business.
Uh-huh.
But I remember thinking like, all right, like you got the job, now you have to do the job.
Were you scared?
A little bit. But then I was like, you know, again, it's like, you got the job.
Mm.
They're not going to fire you, which I'm sure they could have.
But, yeah, that seems rather cocky.
But I knew they weren't because, first of all, it had taken so long to get the job that I was like, they're in for a penny, in for a pound at this point. And I knew I had done all of these scenes basically in my various auditions. So it was like I had an idea of most of them. And I was pretty off book by that point for the whole script.
Because you'd literally done the whole
thing. Because
I'd
done all of them in an audition at some point.
8 times. Yeah. And how soon after the show started going out did you realize, oh, this is, people love this?
I mean, there was buzz before it even aired. And then pretty much out of the gate, it was a phenomenon.
Right.
It started.
Are you getting recognized in Whole Foods straight
no,
away?
No, it was not that phenomenon.
Right.
No one saw it. It was just a critical success.
Right.
So I had a few years where, you know, every now and again, someone would be like, aren't you on that show?
What's it called?
It's on A&E.
Crazy Guys?
It's not on A&E. It's on AMC. Right, AMC. Because no one had AMC. No one could see
it.
Right. Again, pre-streaming, pre-binging, pre-anything. But it was a critical hit immediately. I won the Golden Globe year one. We won the Golden Globe year one. We won the Emmy year one. Like, it was... Right out of the box, it was critically successful and written about. And it was right at the cusp of, like, blog culture. So the idea of doing TV recaps and TV blogs and all of these critics were writing about it. And not without reason. I mean, it was a dense show. Like, the show was very different in its narrative kind of structure.
Yeah.
It was the first of, you know, I mean, The Sopranos and The Wire were probably the first, but it was one of the first... shows that kind of treated a season as one long story arc.
Mm.
And our first season was captivating, you know, by all accounts. So it was fun. Mm. I mean, that part of it was like, holy shit, we're on a hit.
Yeah.
Like I never had that experience. And a show that we can all be proud of, and a show that I'm really proud of, and a show that I'm the lead of, and all of these things that I was like, I'm allowed to be proud of these things. Like it is good, and I am happy with my work in it.
You're becoming known for playing this rather dark, smooth, inscrutable, untrustworthy guy. Very far from who the real John Hamm is. Did you feel any duty to redress that, to let the public know that I'm a nice guy?
Not really. I mean, I mostly I was aware that I didn't want to just keep playing that part. Because when people finally started seeing it, and by people I mean people in the industry, then it was like, ooh, play this part. Ooh, play this part. It's a guy in a hat with a cigarette.
You wear a
hat. Drinks a lot. And has a, you know, or it's a guy in the 60s. Like,
yeah.
You could do that. And I was like, but I do that 4 months out of the year. Like, I don't want to do that.
See, I have a theory about you that you're actually rather an old-fashioned character actor who happens to exist in the body of an old-fashioned leading man.
I don't know about that.
And that Don Draper, therefore, is a rather it's a beautiful, detailed piece of acting.
Well, that is true. I mean, I remember the first time I hosted Saturday Night Live, someone had submitted a sketch at Read Through that was a Don Draper thing, and I had to kind of put on Don Draper. And Steve Higgins, who's one of the producers, came after Read Through, and he was like, oh. He goes, you're doing a character when you do Don Draper. I was like, well, yeah. He goes, I didn't know that. I thought that was just you. I was like, dude, come on. And so, yeah, it's very much a series of choices and supported choices and choices that I think about and do. And I think over the course of 93 episodes or whatever it was, seven seasons, there was a lot of opportunity to really explore those choices and explore that character.
What did you smoke? I mean, you're all smoking all the time.
They're, you know, stage cigarettes, whatever.
That stink? It must have been the smelliest soundstage. Because those herbal cigarettes, they're great.
We did have a situation where, you know, because the offices had ceilings. I mean, that was a big part of the look of the show, you know, it was that drop ceiling. And so the air conditioning units in the ceilings were box fans that were, whenever we would cut, they would flip those on and suck all the smoke out into the stage. So it wasn't great, but you got used to it.
But then you might meet people after work who would think, what are you stink? Have you been smoking?
They do stink. But yeah, you know, I also had like 92 pounds of gel in my hair. So it was kind of like, you know.
Did you ruin a few pillowcases?
Least of my worries.
It's very much about sexual politics of a time, isn't it? Did the sexual politics within the thing ever have any repercussions on set?
The sexual politics of 2018-19 right now are wildly different than they were in 2006 through 2015.
Yeah.
When we were making the show. I think it was a fairly well-behaved set. There wasn't, at least anything that I saw, there wasn't anything untoward. Obviously, there was, you know, in the narrative of the show, there was stuff that wouldn't fly today or then or even in the 70s. I mean, there's a scene where an account executive drunkenly chases down a drunk secretary and shows her panties to the whole office. I mean, like, that wouldn't fly.
Mm.
But, you know, and my character's entire way of being wouldn't necessarily fly. But, you know, for the narrative of the show to kind of whitewash that or whatever, dilute that in any way would have been ridiculous.
Mm.
You know, I remember there was pushback early on when we were making the pilot. Like, do they have to smoke? And Matt was like, yeah. They absolutely do.
Yeah.
Everyone does. Because everyone did.
Yeah.
If they don't, it would be weird. And the people that didn't smoke were kind of looked at like, what's wrong with you?
Mm.
What are you, a health nut? So, yeah, you know, I mean, it was addressed by being put in the show unvarnished.
Mm.
And I think, like, a lot of the things in the show, the juxtaposition of seeing that behavior and thinking about it in a 21st century workplace or 21st century sensibility was like, well, I hope we've come far or at least come some way. And then you look at the events of the last couple of years and what's come out and you think like, well, maybe we haven't.
Well, sure. Yeah. But maybe the fact that we're having the debate.
At least it's been giving credence and people are being believed when they're saying like, this guy was a creeper.
And maybe part of what Mad Men does is by, you know, showing how far the conversation moved on.
It might have been an instigation of a lot of that stuff. I don't know. You know, I defend Don in a lot of ways. I think, you know, he's such a broken... He comes from such a broken life that for him to have become, you know, remotely as successful as he has in any way, shape, or form, obviously he's going to have some some real issues, but he's a survivor. And, you know, he has, you know, tried to make something out of his life, and he's in many ways succeeded and in many ways failed. But I think that that's about as real a portrayal of a human being as you can, is like, look, I did some things right and I did some things wrong. Mm. And, you know, my marriage wasn't great. It was built on a lie, but I have three great kids that I love. My job is weird. I don't know how to handle it, but that's what I do, and I do it really well. I think that it's that kind of nebulous somewhere on the spectrum of good and bad that I think true, interesting, rich characters come from, whether it's me or Walter White or Tony Soprano or, you know, fill in the blank, what have you.
So it's this huge hit. You start getting nominated for every acting award on the planet. Would that feel like an important validation after all the years of chugging?
Sure did. You know, it was nice to be invited to sit at the big table.
Mm.
And I would look around and think like, holy cow, like I'm in the same group as Jeff Daniels and Bryan Cranston and God, Kyle Chandler and Damian Lewis and, you know, fill in the blank.
Mm.
People that are, whose work I just respect and just like enjoy watching and think like, you know, wow, like not only am I in that group, but I'm the favorite or I'm the whatever. So you think, yeah, cool, this is great.
You do 7 seasons and by the end of it, you're on Sexiest Man Alive lists and you've got all these prizes. You've become something of a household name. Life is very different, presumably. But after 92 episodes, are you ready? Are you kind of, I can leave this now.
Yeah. I also think just where it landed in the narrative of, it felt like the right place to stop.
Right.
You know, it felt like this is the last page of the novel and we turn it and it says the end.
Yeah.
And then you close the book and you put it on the shelf and hopefully maybe you read it again in a couple of years and think, oh man, I got something different out of it this time. Yeah. You know, it felt like, it's what I love about British television. It's not open-ended.
Right.
It stops. It's a story. It's a story that has a beginning, middle, and end. So you don't get sick of it. There's not that thing of like sticking around at the party too long.
Yeah.
I appreciated that a lot of the decision to, look, when something's making money, everybody wants it to keep going forever. But people don't realize that the reason it's making money is because people like it. And if it goes on forever, people will eventually not like it.
Mm.
You can't tell a story indefinitely. How can we miss you if you won't go away? You know, like that kind of thing. So I think that idea, you know, people, oh, are you going to do a movie? Are you going to do this? Are you going to, no, no, it's done.
Right.
It's done. It was great. It was fun while it lasted.
But do you grieve for it?
I did, definitely. I mean, yeah, I think you have to.
Mm.
It was 9 years of my life, 2006 to 2015. You know, the better part of all of my 30s, essentially, 35, well, half 30s and half 40s. But it was, yeah, it's a huge chunk of my life. And a chunk of like a, you know, significant part of my sort of maturity and life and adult life. And, you know, that's like kind of the good years. But yeah, it was wonderful. You know, it was a great job and it was a job that enabled me to get other amazing jobs and meet great people and work with amazing people and learn so much. And, yeah, I look back on it very fondly.
And when I look at the stuff, the list of stuff you've done since, it feels a little bit like that. That you feel a little bit like someone who's been let loose in a candy store a little bit. Because the range of things you now seem to choose to do, it's so varied. Baby Driver, and then you do Bridesmaids, and then you do Absolutely Fabulous. You know, you seem to enjoy the thrill of the variety.
I that's very true. And I think that if there is a through line to all those seemingly random things that I do, it's that they're all either with people whose work I really respect.
Right.
Or something that I think will be challenging or scary to do that I haven't done, or they look like be totally fun.
Yeah. It's fun.
I did
a day
on AbFab.
Yeah.
I watch AbFab. I love Joanna and Jennifer. Like, their approach to that material is so loose and winning and great and serious, and they do all the work and stuff, but they had asked me to come in and do a day, fly to London, do a day on the show. And I was like, yeah, you kidding me? Sounds like a blast. And I'm doing a scene with Kate Moss and,
yeah,
you know, Gwendolyn Christie's there. Like, there's so many, like, it's like a circus.
Yeah.
We were shooting in Wapping, of all places. And across from the stages where we're shooting, there's a pub. And we all go to the pub for lunch. So the barman is wiping down the bar. It's whatever, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. There's nobody in this pub.
Yeah.
And Jennifer Saunders, Joanna Lumley, Kate Moss, Gwendolyn Christie, me, Lulu, all these people walk into the pub, and the dude is just like, wait, what? Like, is happening here? Hey, man, how's it going? Yeah, Kate Moss, whatever. And we proceed to have, like, kind of a long, boozy lunch and then go back to work and finish up the day. And I was like, of course I'll do this. This is a blast.
Is fun a big motivating factor for you now?
It's not the only one, but it's certainly, yeah, you know, if something looks like it would be just a blast like that, a blast to do, of course.
Because you've done a lot of comedy, haven't you?
I've done my fair share, but I've tried to temper it with, you know, and it's a specific kind of comedy. Like, I for example, our thing, Good Omens, I think was wildly funny, but it's specifically funny.
Yeah.
It's a little more on the kind of, I don't know, intellectual side of it. I love Neil's writing. I've been a fan of his work for years and years and years. So, example, when he said, hey, would you maybe want to do this thing? It's not in the book, but we're writing a thing. I just said, yes, whatever it is, I'll do it.
Does that drive your representatives mad? Because that's not always the Hollywood way, is it?
No, they like go crazy. They're just like, oh, you idiot. Like, why do you keep saying yes to these things? You know, because that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
Over the course of the last hour or so and talking to you, you know, flashing back to the time where you didn't have the opportunity to do what you wanted to do, or you had to kind of make the opportunity to do what you wanted to do. Like, why would you say no? Money? Who cares? Like, it's like the money part of it is the last consideration, which I realize I'm in a wildly privileged and a place to say that. But
yeah, but having got there, why then you should be allowed to.
Exactly. I feel like that is the benefit of removing that stressor. You know, whether it's working with Edgar on Baby Driver, which I knew would be playing the big bad in that, really, to working with Charlie Brooker on Black Mirror, playing a much more seemingly nice guy that then we realize is not so nice. I've gotten to work with some people in my life. If I could, you know, kind of look back and tell my 14-year-old self, like, you know what? You're going to get to work with Tom Cruise one day, and it's going to be really awesome.
Yeah.
Which I'm doing right now.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, you're in the sequel.
Sequel to Top Gun. Like, there's another example. Like, agents were like, do you really want to do this? I was like, are you kidding me?
It's the sequel to Top Gun.
It's Top Gun. Yes, I do. Well, the money's not this. I was like, I don't care. I don't care. I will be good in this. I will have fun on this, and it will be Top Gun 2.
Yeah. Oh, and then, of course, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. You're reunited with...
Well, I had also worked with Ellie on Bridesmaids.
Of course you have. Yeah. Yes, of course
She was on Bridesmaids with me. And so, and she was also on The Office, which I was not on, but The Office was sort of in the Emmy swirl and the Golden Globe swirl when we were so...
As you were on that circuit together, right?
We had a lot of red carpet moments, and I just remember one point or another, we were kind of next in line to each other on the big step and repeat line.
Yeah.
And I remember looking over at her and being like, hi, because the last time I had seen her was when she was a kid. I was very chuffed, as they would say.
You seem very at ease with where you are. Do you get angry and resentful? Do you kind of have moments going, how does that actor get that part?
Less and less.
Right.
I think as I get older and more experienced and more have more of a perspective on everything, I realize, like, it's wasted energy. It's really waste, and it's non-productive, and I think it's actually harmful to motivate yourself in that way. Why that guy? I always say, why not me? You know, I'm good enough. It sounds like, you know, Stuart Smalley. I'm good enough. I'm smart enough. And gosh darn it, people like me. But also, there's so much of this business that you don't have any concept of what's going on behind the curtain. And if you did, you'd rather not know, because how the sausage is made is kind of gross in certain things. And you think like, oh, that guy got that because of this and that. And so many other things, and agencies representing other people, and horse trading, and all that nonsense that goes on, especially at the studio level. Mm. Oh, this guy is mean. This guy means this much money foreign, and this guy means this much money in this place. And you'll drive yourself crazy thinking that way. And again, I realize like I'm in an incredibly privileged position to even have that perspicacity to sort of remove myself from that worry. But I've tried to be less and less judgmental about all that stuff the longer I've been around. It's like, all right, good for you. Good for you. I'm happy for you. I'm the first guy to, as you well know, I'm the first guy to recommend somebody for a part where I'm like, oh, you know who'd be great for this? David Tennant.
So where do you want to be in 10 years' time? What would be?
I don't know. You know, happy, stable. You know, it's more kind of generalized adjectives than anything. You know, I can't be, oh, I want a franchise, and I want a this, and I want a that, and yeah. Stuff I don't need. It's more intellectual and emotional satisfaction, I think, that I'm looking for. And that's a fun pursuit, too.
John, thank you.
Cheers, mate.
David Tennant Does a Podcast With is a Something Else and No Mystery production. Produced and edited by James Deacon. Additional production from Chris Skinner, Steve Ackerman, Sarah Camlett, Josh Gibbs, Dave King, Jake Valentine, Joel Freeman, Magda Saron, and Georgia Tennant. Next time.
It was so embarrassing. My first big interview, foreign affairs, talking to the world, and I got the country wrong. They're just incredible. And I'll never forget that.
Also from Something Else.
How did we get here? With Claudia Winkleman and Professor Tanya Byron. In these in-depth, one-on-one therapy sessions, we dig deep into personal stories with fascinating and emotional revelations. A passionate, insightful, and moving experience with clear outcomes to each episode.
He is as anxious about attachment with you as you are with him.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. That's crazy, isn't it? Oh, that's a weird feeling. Wait, so... Oh, God. Don't you just feel like, whoa, why didn't I know that all along?
Listen now in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all good podcast apps.